All right, I'll call the third case on the docket, case number 244014, Jensen v. Life Insurance Company of North America. Please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Brian King on behalf of the plaintiff, Jill Jensen. Ms. Jensen is with us in the courtroom today also. We have a case, a tragic case involving a loss of Stephen Jensen. He had been prescribed oxycodone for treatment of chronic pain. And then on January 30th of 2019, he was prescribed clonazepam to treat anxiety. 2 days later, he passed away. His autopsy and the toxicology report indicated that he passed away from a toxic combination of those two drugs. And they ruled his death an accident. The evidence suggested that Stephen was taking the medications appropriately, but there was a combination of the two that caused his death. He submitted, Jill, on his behalf, submitted a claim to Lina for accidental death and disability, or dismemberment, rather, benefits. And Lina refused to pay those benefits, arguing just two things. Initially, they argued that there was a common exclusion which excluded coverage for voluntary ingestion of drugs unless those drugs were prescribed or taken as prescribed. It also initially relied on common exclusion number 7, which Lina argued excluded coverage for death resulting from medical treatment of any sickness, disease, bodily or mental infirmity, or any bacterial or viral infections. There was some back and forth in the pre-litigation appeal process. Ms. Jensen retained an attorney, Mr. Higley, who provided information to show that, in fact, there was no non-prescribed or overdose of the medication, that there was nothing about the autopsy or the toxicology report that suggested that Mr. Jensen had done anything other than take those drugs as prescribed.
This was provided to Lina pre-suit?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. And also pre-suit, Lina issued a final denial that it was a little ambiguous exactly what they were doing. They had a report from Dr. Tovar that they had retained, a doctor who himself suggested and stated that he could find no reason to think there was any improper taking of the prescription medication, that there was no overdose on the part of Mr. Jensen. They came down as a final basis for denial and said, it's exclusion 7 that we're relying on. And there have been attempts made once we were in litigation to suggest that maybe exclusion 11 was something that came into play. But I think it's a fair statement and undisputed that the last thing they ended up saying in their denial letter in the pre-litigation appeal process was that exclusion 7 applies. So the question is, the district court took the case and said, well, I think exclusion 7 in a clear, unambiguous way precludes the claim, means that the claim has to be denied. Our position is one of two things. Number one, we disagree entirely and say that exclusion 7 actually shows in its clear, unambiguous language that it doesn't apply and that, in fact, the claim should have been paid. But alternatively, that there is some ambiguity, and this is the last antecedent argument that we made throughout the briefs. There's some ambiguity, whether it's on the face of the language of exclusion 7 itself, or ambiguity created by some of the other language in the exclusions, namely how you read exclusion 11 and how you read exclusion together, or exclusion 7 together, that creates ambiguity in a way that causes us to say the standard of review becomes important. Because if it's a de novo standard of review, this court and the district court should interpret ambiguities
why,
in favor of the insurer.
Why isn't it an abuse of discretion review?
Why, well,
is it not abuse of discretion or arbitrary and capricious as it's alternatively called?
The reason for that, Your Honor, is the state of Utah, long before the...
But we have Delaware law applying here.
We
apply federal choice of law
that's,
rules. And federal choice of law rules allow us to say that the choice of law provision in an ERISA, under ERISA, controls.
Right.
And here the choice of law is Delaware.
That's right.
And the only other thing that's required is that there be a connection to the, between the plan and the law that's chosen, the state's law that's chosen. And here there's definitely a connection because the employer, which was, I'm trying to remember the name of the employer, Cope,
Codell.
Is a Delaware.
Yes.
Corporation. So I'm struggling to see why we would have any basis to apply Utah law here.
Here's the problem.
Which I understand you want applied because Utah doesn't allow this type of.
The bans on discretionary authority clauses. That's right, Your Honor. Here's the problem for the defendants in this case, for Lina.
I don't want what the problem is for the defendants. I want you to tell me why we wouldn't apply Delaware.
Because the state of Utah has put in its insurance code specific prohibitions on insurers choosing law that precludes or guts the ability of the legislature of the state of Utah to protect Utah residents from overreaching choice of law provisions. Right. Now, the Supreme Court.
That law only applies if Utah law applies.
That's right. Well, that's a bit of a chicken and egg argument that you've identified, Judge Moritz, because the Supreme Court in the ERISA in the context of Kentucky Association of Health Plans versus Miller many years ago, 20 years ago, said we're going to allow states to pass laws that regulate insured products if they affect the risk bearing, the risk allocation between the parties. And if they are aimed directly at the insurance code and at the insurance industry, we certainly have a provision in the Utah code way back from like the 1990s or long, long before even the discretionary authority ban that says you can't say to Utah residents, we're going to choose the law of a state other than Utah to regulate the insurance obligation.
The statute you're talking about, Section 2, it's 31A, 2113, 314, says an insurance policy subject to this chapter can't contain such a provision. The problem is we're not subject to this chapter because we're applying federal choice of law principles, and under those principles, Delaware law applies. So we're not subject to this chapter.
We are subject to this chapter because you're talking about a Utah resident here. And you're talking about an insurance product aimed at a Utah resident. And to adopt the argument that Lina is asking for here, Your Honor, is to say, we're going to allow insurance departments and legislatures of the various states with regard to insurance products to lose their ability to protect their residents by an insurance company, Lina in this case, saying, we're going to, as a matter of boilerplate, put in our policies, pick and choose of the 50 states, the law that applies that's most favorable to us, to the detriment of the policies of the protection of the people of the state that live in the state where the policies are being produced and provided. So.
Well, let's assume for a minute that an abuse of discretion policy applies and I think that changes your argument, doesn't it?
A little.
We've got to have a reasonable.
That's right.
Reasonable basis, and in this case, why would it not have been reasonable?
Here's why.
To apply Exclusion 7.
Here's why, Your Honor, because Exclusion 7, by its very language, including the last decedent rule, simply does not apply here in a situation where we've got the circumstance where you have a death as a result of medical or surgical treatment in the form of prescription medications that is applied to this kind of illness that Mr. Jensen was suffering from. Anxiety, chronic pain, those two things did not cause his death. There's no question, based on what Lina said in the pre-litigation appeal process, that they accepted that this was a covered loss.
Okay, so let me just clarify first. I think there's a couple steps you've taken here that I want to make sure I understand. So in deciding that this was not reasonable, you think we should look at the Clause 7 and we should read it as you're reading it, as though the clause or medical or surgical treatment thereof only applies to bacterial or viral infection.
Correct.
And we would do that because of the rule of construction, the antecedent.
Yeah, the last antecedent.
Right. That doesn't make sense to me for a number of reasons, but assuming we disagree with you, What's your argument?
Well, then the argument is take a look at the interrelationship between Exclusion 11 and Exclusion 7. Exclusion 11 clearly, Your Honor, states that when you have a voluntary ingestion of a narcotic drug, poison, gas, or fumes as prescribed by a doctor that causes a death, that is outside the scope of the exclusion for the particular circumstance where a loss is caused by a drug. So Exclusion 11 is more specific, number one. And number two, the language of Exclusion 11 itself says, if you have these an individual taking drugs by prescription, it falls outside the exclusion of the framework of the policy. There's no question that we've got a covered loss here. Lina has never said there's anything other than a covered loss. The only question is, do any exclusions apply? Again, the Tenth Circuit's very clear in saying it's Lina that bears the burden of proving that an exclusion applies. You've got to read, you can't just read number 7 alone, you have to read number 11 with number 7.
I mean, reading 11 like you do, though, I mean, if somebody ingested poison, you know, some kind of noxious gas or fumes and death resulted. I mean, wouldn't we, under your analysis, wouldn't we then try to determine if a physician had told them to do that?
Well, I mean, it's not.
This thing's full of drafting problems and like our Payless case, I mean, we've not hesitated to get around that.
And when we have drafting problems, the Tenth Circuit's very clear when you're talking about exclusions. The burden of loss, the risk of loss associated with ambiguity falls on Lina. It does not fall on Ms. Jensen. And that's important, because I think what we have here is a failure on the part of Lina to act reasonably in evaluating how they inform their insureds about what the coverage of the scope of the coverage is.
What you just said, though, again, I think you're assuming that de novo review applies, because if it's just arbitrary and capricious, we're not gonna say that an ambiguity is resolved in favor of the insured.
Well,
your argument keeps hopping over, but I want to make
yeah. No, there's a relationship between the two.
You've got to have two different arguments here.
There's a relationship between the two, but I do acknowledge, Judge Meritz, that we feel strongly that the plain, unambiguous language of the policy, when you read 7, especially when you read 7 with 11, results in a ruling in favor of coverage and requires a reversal. If I may reserve my time.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the Court. Christina Holmstrom, on behalf of Defendant Life Insurance Company of North America, or Lina, as it's much easier to say. I would like to start with where Judge Moritz picked up your questioning, and that is with the choice of law provision that we have in the policy. The case that governs this is Ellis versus Liberty Life. It is recent. It is published. The Tenth Circuit denied en banc review, leaving it to stand as is. And it is clear. Federal choice of law rules apply to the choice of law analysis in an ERISA policy. This was also recently described in some length in a case out of the Central District of California, a case called Ehrlich, which we cited in our briefs. And it wouldn't make any sense from an ERISA, from a federal preemption standpoint, to start the choice of law inquiry by looking at state law. Neither Miller nor any of the other preemption cases that deal with saved state insurance regulation statutes talk about which state's law is saved. And that's the issue we have here. It's not that no state law is saved. We're looking at the policy, the plan, to determine which state's law is saved. And here, under Ellis, it's Delaware. That leaves the standard of review as an abuse of discretion. I am unaware of any case, I could have missed one, but I'm unaware of any case in which a court has looked at Lina's policy language and said that it unambiguously only excludes medical or surgical treatment for bacterial viral infection. In other words, I'm aware that there are other cases that have looked at whether this language is ambiguous, found that it has been, and construed it against the drafter. I'm unaware of any court that's found that it unambiguously confers coverage where somebody dies from medical treatment due to a sickness. And that's an important distinction when you're talking about abuse of discretion review. Beyond that, however...
Can you explain that a little more precisely?
Yes.
Because I'm struggling a little bit with both of your arguments as they pertain to the two different possible standards of review, which are very much different here.
Yes.
As I understand it, the insurer, if we apply abuse of discretion, the insurer simply has to have a reasonable basis.
Yes, and if I
do. And what is your argument that this was reasonable?
At the very best, what we have is an ambiguous policy. And I don't think that's true. There has only been one other circuit-level decision to analyze this policy language, and that was the Vieira case out of the Third Circuit. And the Third Circuit found that this policy language, despite the lack of commas, unambiguously excluded coverage from medical or surgical treatment of sickness, disease, bodily or mental infirmity, as well as bacterial or viral infection. So,
well, if we're and clarify for me, if we are applying abuse of discretion review and we decide that exclusion 7 is ambiguous,
then yes.
Then do we apply the contra preferendum rule?
No, Your Honor. Contra preferentum does not apply in discretionary cases because if something is ambiguous, it's reasonably susceptible to more than one interpretation. And under abuse of discretion review, we get to have the reasonable interpretation, which we have here. Okay. Again, though, I would reiterate that I don't think this is an ambiguous policy term. So even under de novo review, as in the Vieira case, which was also a de novo case, there's no ambiguity in the policy. And if the court will indulge me for just a little bit, I want to take...
Well, the argument, though, you need to address, I don't think it's addressed in the Vieira case, is that somehow exclusion 11, when read with exclusion 7, makes it ambiguous.
Yes, Your Honor, I'm happy to explain. I disagree. There's a way...
It does seem that originally you wanted to rely on both exclusions. And
yes.
And then when you receive some facts indicating... Exclusion 11 may not apply, then you simply relied on 7.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. And that's part of the reasonable dialogue process that ERISA sets up in requiring this administrative back and forth. When Lina first obtained the medical records, there was some suggestion that there were a lot more pills missing than should have been from the remaining pill bottles. So based on the initial information, Lina had a reasonable basis to assert that voluntary ingestion exclusion 11. It, in good faith, considered the additional evidence that Ms. Jensen provided, went and got a third-party expert's opinion. Third-party expert said, yeah, we can't tell whether he, you know, we can't prove he was not taking them as prescribed. So Lina withdrew its reliance on exclusion 11. But exclusion 7 and 11 can absolutely be read in harmony, and here's how. If an insured is prescribed a medication to treat the insured for an accidental injury and takes that medication as prescribed by the doctor and that medication causes a covered loss or causes a loss, that is covered under the exception to exclusion 11. Okay, because there's no involvement of a sickness or bodily infirmity. But anytime,
but it doesn't say that
without a bodily infirmity or a sickness. Why would you take a prescription when you don't have a bodily infirmity or a sickness?
For an injury. So if I got into a car accident,
that's not a bodily infirmity.
No, I don't think that would be. I mean, it's hypothetical at this point. I don't think it would be a fair interpretation of this policy language to say that if I got into a car accident and broke my arm and I got prescribed pain medication just for that break, and I had some adverse reaction and died without any sickness, I think that would have to be a covered death as long as I was taking those medications as prescribed by the doctor, as contemplated in exclusion 11. And I want to highlight...
But you would not say that 11 applies if a drug or narcotic is being taken for a disease. You say it applies
correct.
Only in an accident.
Correct. To an accidental injury,
why
yes.
Doesn't it say in paragraph 11, accident?
It doesn't need to. It's two separate things. The exclusions seem related, especially under this type of fact pattern, but they cover discrete situations. So the medical, exclusion number seven, the medical treatment exclusion, covers any time an insured suffers a loss in connection with being treated for a sickness or an illness or some type of mental infirmity.
Right, I get that.
The voluntary ingestion, you know, there's innumerable ways somebody might be taking a drug or medication that might have no relation to a sickness. Somebody could just be taking oxycodone to get high, in which case there would be no application of exclusion 11, seven. Exclusion 11.
I understand that as an explanation.
Yeah.
But what I don't understand is that explanation without paragraph 11 saying for things other than sickness, disease, bodily or mental infirmity, bacterial or viral infection, for things other than that, voluntary ingestion of a narcotic, according to the doctor's prescription, is not excluded. Okay. 11 does not say that it is subservient to 7. And that's what you're saying.
I'm not saying it's subservient. I'm saying it's harmonious. You have to read them together.
Okay.
And if I might.
Okay, that may work if the standard is abuse of discretion, but it doesn't work so much if it's de novo. Do you agree with that?
I don't. And okay, here's
tell
why.
Me why.
So this is more fleshed out in the Grobe case, which we cited. But I think the court was concerned that exclusion 11 doesn't specifically say if you're taking medication for an accident. And it wouldn't have to, because to even get to the exclusions, you have to have a covered loss, which already requires an accidental injury. It's already in there in the coverage analysis. By the time you get to exclusion 11, you're already dealing with an accidental injury. You're then looking to see if there's anything else that might carve out coverage. And here, there is covered in exclusion 11. There will be no payment if the death was caused by voluntary ingestion of a drug, unless, and here we have an exception, unless that drug is being taken as prescribed by a doctor. Now, that's an exception to an exclusion. An exception to exclusion 11 cannot create coverage that is otherwise excluded under number 7. And if the court will indulge me for just a moment, I have a hypothetical. Under Ms. Jensen's reading of exclusion 7, which is the medical treatment exclusion, we will all agree that medical loss due to medical treatment for a virus is excluded. There's nothing ambiguous about that. Even under the last antecedent rule, that's excluded. So if I get COVID and I'm being treated with medication for COVID and I take that medication exactly as prescribed by my doctor and I still die from it, under exclusion 7, that's excluded. Under Ms. Jensen's reading of exclusion 11, it's covered. That's an irreconcilable difference between the exclusions. The only way these exclusions can be read together, and they have to be, because the court doesn't write out any part of a policy, and it doesn't disregard any part of policy, and it doesn't nullify a part of a policy. The only way to read these two together is that your death will be covered if it's from medication, if that medication is taken for an accidental injury, and taken exactly as prescribed by a doctor. That's how you read those harmoniously, and that's what the Grobe case really goes into. I know it's a district court case. It's not binding on this court, but the logic is persuasive. And I think that, you know, just taking a step back and going back to the Vieira case with the Third Circuit, the reason why Exclusion 7 is not ambiguous is because you have to look at it in the context of the entire exclusion and the policy itself. So the policy is very clear up front. It is a limited policy. This is not a life insurance policy. Ms. Jensen received her life insurance benefits from Lina. This is a much more limited in scope type of coverage. And when you look at Exclusion 7, you have this list of things that are excluded: sickness, illness, bodily, mental infirmity, and then bacterial or viral infection. Okay. The only way that exclusion makes sense is if you apply the medical treatment therefore to the entire preceding list. Otherwise, you end up with absurd results. Again, going back to my COVID example, if I die from treatment related to COVID, that would unequivocally be excluded. But if I die from treatment of diabetes, under Ms. Jensen's reading of the policy, that would have to be covered. And there's not a reason within the purpose of AD&D coverage to distinguish between different types of illness and their treatment thereof. I'll give you an even more nuanced example. Say I have pneumonia. Pneumonia can often is caused by viral or bacterial infection. It can also be caused by fungal infection. So are we saying that if I die from treatment of pneumonia, coverage is going to depend on what type of pneumonia that is? That is what the Payless court referred to as a crazy quilt analysis of what it is and isn't covered. And that's why you have to take a step back, look at what the policy was intended to cover. I do want to briefly hit the Payless decision.
Let me ask you a question first. Mm-hmm. Because you agree, don't you, that one of the things we have to do is try to give effect to all of the language in the policy?
Yes.
Okay. And I look at paragraph, your exclusion number 11, and it seems to me that under your argument today, the unless clause, the unless prescribed or taken under the direction of a physician and taken in accordance with the prescribed dosage, is just surplusage. It doesn't matter because you're not going to voluntarily ingest a narcotic or a drug unless you're one, abusing it, or two, you have a prescription for a medical infirmity of some sort.
No, Your Honor, that was my example with the accidental injury. The way that a death is covered due to taking a prescribed medication is if that medication is prescribed for an injury as opposed to any kind of sickness. And that's how you harmonize these two exclusions.
Right. And your position would be, well, that accidental injury wouldn't be a bodily infirmity.
Correct.
Okay.
I think under the way this policy works and these two provisions, I think I would have a hard time standing up here and arguing to the court that taking pain medication for a broken arm somehow is treatment for a bodily infirmity. I think that would make these irreconcilable. But
does it matter to you that what we have here is not a situation where someone just took a drug for an infirmity or for whatever, but we have an unexpected drug interaction that caused death?
That's exactly what the Exclusion 7 is intended to provide. There are innumerable ways that medical treatment can go awry. Drug interactions, surgical mishaps. Exclusion 7 broadly is meant to exclude all of those things from coverage if the origin of that treatment is a sickness or a bodily or mental infirmity. And that's consistent with how AD&D coverage functions. Again, different than life. Life is very broad. But when you look at the policy as a whole, and Payless says that you must, it is intended to exclude any death that starts, that has its origin with a sickness or a bodily or mental infirmity. And that's exactly what we have here. It was a tragic loss. I don't deny that. It's just simply not covered under AD&D coverage.
Did you ever suggest that it wasn't an accidental loss at all? And why not?
Well, so
based on what you're saying.
So we don't have a causal link between the sickness he was being treated for and the death. So in other words, his chronic pain didn't cause his death. Therefore, it does broadly come within the insurance clause, the insuring clause.
Does it come within the definition of accidental loss?
I think it does. And that's why you have to apply the exclusion. Okay. Because the coverage starts with the coverage provision, right? You then have to look at the exclusion to see what is subtracted from coverage. And my time is up, so if the panel does not have any more questions, I'll sit down. Thank you.
I want to start where Lina ended. And your question, Judge Moritz, there was never an argument in the pre-litigation appeal process from Lina that we did not fall within the covered loss provisions. This case is relatively simple and focused on the relationship between Exclusion 7 and Exclusion 11. And I just don't see how Lina's position today can be reconciled with Exclusion 11.
Offers a basis. She offers a rationale. She offers a hypothetical. Under abuse of discretion review, all they have to do is have a reasonable argument. Why isn't that reasonable?
It is not reasonable to say we can't provide coverage when there is a loss caused by the use of any prescription drugs arising out of treatment of a sickness, disease, or bodily or mentally infirmity. That's unreasonable. Those two provisions of 7 and 11 can't be reconciled in that way. I want to also get back to the Ellis case and one of the things that we talked about at the beginning of the discussion in connection with your concerns, Judge Mertz, which is the Ellis case Tenth Circuit case that talks about the degree to which choice of law provisions need to be deferred to, does not talk about in that case whether it's a self-funded or a fully insured plan. And this, there's no question here in this case, we've got a fully insured plan. The language of the Supreme Court in the FMC versus Holiday case, much more importantly, the specific savings clause of ERISA itself, preserve the ability of states to regulate their own insurance products and protect their own citizens. It's absolutely improper from our perspective to allow Lina in this case with regard to its fully insured products to say, you know what, we're going to pick out the best state regulations for insurance that we can find. That's what's going
to
govern.
Well, that's the reason why you have to have a connection to the state, and they do here.
Well, even if they have a connection.
The employer is based out of Delaware.
It's not the kind of connection that Utah's connection is to having the need and feeling the need and wanting to protect the Jill Jensens of the world from overreaching insurance practices. I don't argue that there's not a connection, Your Honor. So,
okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments. They've been very helpful. And the case will be submitted and counsel are excused.